So many of you may remember Dana Barron's talk here, I think it was 2012, on his true hike of Vermont's Long Trail. I did it as he did, as a present to myself for turning 50. When I was preparing for my journey, many folks had questions. Some were technical, planning, training, equipment sorts of questions. Some simply asked, why? A couple of them were like, good Lord, why? I didn't have a ready answer at the time, and this talk is really my attempt at piecing one together. So, why? I'm reminded at first of Edmund Hillary's response to why he needed to climb Mount Everest. Not that I'm trying to compare myself to him. He said, because it's there. I don't want to detract from Hillary's record, but I don't think that answer really reaches it. Lots of things are there for Hillary and each of us. Depending on who we are, we might find ourselves drawn to cooking, day trading, restoring corvettes, fly fishing, wine collecting. The list is endless. But each of us chooses to do some things and not others. Because it's there, I think, is insufficient. Not examining why we're drawn to an activity is a missed opportunity to understand more about ourselves. There's another non-answer that I'd like to speak to as well. If you have to ask, then you'll never understand. That's insulting. And it avoids answering the question. To ask someone simply, honestly, sincerely, why? Or perhaps better, what moves you to do this? I think deserves at least an attempt at a real answer. So I'm going to tell you what I think drove me to this hike, and I'm going to tell you a few trail stories as well as part of my answer to the question, why? Let me begin with a few things you might not know about me. For years, I've enjoyed reading online journals written by thru-hikers on trailjournals.com. It's been a vicarious experience I could enjoy while working at my desk. Each spring, I'd select one or two likely thru-hikers who seemed to write like they knew what they were doing, and I'd follow their travels as I hiked the Appalachian Trail or the Pacific Crest Trail. Over time, I became more and more intrigued with the hiking community and culture. To give you a quick taste of that community right now, a common hiker expression uses yogi, Y-O-G-I, as a verb. To use it correctly in a sentence, a hiker heading into a campground might smell something cooking and tell his or her companions, "Ooh, wow, that smells great. Let's see if we can yogi some steaks." Second, I'm an introvert. That doesn't mean I can't enjoy others' company or even public speaking. It means those sorts of things cost me energy, while time alone helps me recharge. Time alone in a forest and mountains is nearly paradise to me, at least in the abstract. Vermont's Long Trail has the distinction of being the oldest long-distance hiking trail in the United States. Construction was begun in 1910, and it was reasonably complete by 1925. It runs along the spine of the Green Mountains for a total length of 273 miles today. The Long Trail was, in fact, the inspiration for the Appalachian Trail. But as long-distance trails go these days, the Long Trail is pretty short. Backpackers often say it's both short enough for a vacation, but long enough for an adventure. In my experience, the Long Trail is a very hard trail. Written descriptions often include adjectives like primitive, rough, rugged. I apparently took it more personally. My journal uses harder, more anthropomorphic words like brutal, savage, merciless. If you've hiked any sections of the Long Trail south of Appalachian Gap, which is where Vermont 17 crosses the trail, then you should know that the hard sections in the south are generally equivalent to the easy sections in the north. And I know you don't believe me, but it's true. The trail has lots of rock scrambling and, in many places, full-on rock climbing. Further, the trail is mud in large parts, often knee-deep, which is amazing to find at elevations over 3,000 feet. I didn't expect near so much water. I had dry feet five of my 23 days on the trail, and it wasn't a particularly wet fall. Hikers often refer to our state as Vermud. And I will tell you that name is deserved. But I will also tell you that the hardest thing I had to overcome on this journey was myself, and that was just to get to the start of the trail. To allow myself the time off from my day job and from our farm, and to lay the burden of my work on my wife, Yvonne, to allow that I might not be essential, even if just for a short period of time, was the single most difficult thing for me. Sure, I know the graveyards are full of essential people, but my inner control freak had never really allowed that that ever might apply to me. Hikers on the long trail are either nobos or sobos. That is, they are northbound or southbound. I was a sobo. I began hiking from the Canadian border on September 15th. I figured that if I started in the north, I had a better chance of avoiding snow towards the finish in October. But that also meant the most difficult portion of the trail would come first. Actually, I should say we, because I began my hike with my brother Lance. Lance and I are pretty close, but he lives in Illinois, so we don't see much of one another. Early in my planning, he asked if he could join me, and I was very glad to have his company. Unfortunately, he was working with some real disadvantages. He has an ankle that was surgically repaired from a bad fall and is still somewhat problematic. And he had to train in northern Illinois with limited opportunities to work up stamina for climbing mountains. The trail quickly chewed him up. By day two, his ankle was giving him problems. By day four, he'd torn the meniscus in his opposite knee. He had to leave the trail on day six at the road crossing at Vermont 15 outside of Johnson and caught a shuttle back to Burlington. Fortunately, he was able to recover without surgery, and we had six pretty good days and nights together, the most we'd shared since high school. But it was obviously less than we had planned. Long-distance hikers rely to varying degrees on the kindness of others. They often say things like, "The trail will provide." Reading hiking journals, I thought that was a bit overly idealistic and perhaps the product of some sort of trail-induced delirium. Elements of the hiking community remind me of the 1960s counterculture, so I thought much of this happy talk might be coming from some of that perspective as well. But when I was walking the highway from Jonesville to Richmond to get some more fuel for my cook stove, a fellow in a pickup stopped and asked if I wanted a ride. I didn't have my thumb out, and the hitch found me. Other times, complete strangers offered me food, drink, encouragement, fuel, helpful advice, replacement batteries, interesting conversation, booze, and weed. I had all I needed on my back, but the community around me really did provide much more. Part of the functioning of the trail community also serves to keep hikers aware of the other folks who are walking a day's journey or so in front and behind them. As a sobo, whenever I encountered a nobo, we'd stop and talk about who we'd seen and when. This enabled each of us to learn who was currently in our immediate community. The logbooks in the shelters also helped build this awareness. For example, from shelter logs, I learned that I had started about a week behind two other guys, Achilles and Mr. Z. I managed to catch them both at Seth Warner Shelter on my last night on the trail. And that brings me to trail names. Hikers often assume a trail name, an alias that they go by while on the trail. I think the trail name idea is part fun and part an effort to disassociate oneself from the non-trail world. My trail name is Kale, as in eat more. Some folks chose their names in advance, and some let the trail come up with the name for them. I packed dried kale in all my dinner meals, and that impressed many of my fellow hikers. That's how my name came about. My particular cast of characters on my adventure included Florida Mike, Snags, Turtle, Rockfish, and a retired couple named Ruff and Tumble. Over the years, I've read some interesting things on the nature of happiness. I'm not entirely clear how you can actually quantify happiness, but that aside, studies consistently suggest that the Amish rank among the happiest folks here in the U.S. I suspect their pared-down lifestyle and expectations are some of the contributing factors. I understand from other studies that you actually can buy happiness, but not quite in the way most folks imagine. Buying experiences, particularly through travel, apparently contributes to happiness over time, whereas buying possessions seems to get you nowhere in terms of any lasting happiness. I'm inclined to believe both these findings now after my hike. My trail life was pretty simple. Wake up, pack up, walk south. And many of you know I've not been able to stop talking about my experience. I don't remember ever being as consistently happy, moment to moment, day to day in my life, unless perhaps I was paddling a kayak. It could have been the constant endorphin rush. Whatever the cause, it was totally wonderful. And I will do more. The trail helped me connect with my Zen Buddhist practice in some interesting and useful ways. As best I could, I tried to make the act of hiking a meditative practice. Kinhin is the Zen term for a walking meditation, and the trail actually helped guide me into that practice. If you will, picture in your mind a path in the forest. Is the ground smooth underfoot? Then you're not on the long trail. Rock and root is everywhere, and at least in the northern half of the trail, you won't plant one step in 10 on flat earth. So inattention often leads to a fall or a twisted ankle. That said, the trail was so difficult that even with whatever increased awareness I was able to bring, I had a good hard fall at least daily, and some days I got beaten up more often. Long distance hiking lends itself to introspection. You hike most days alone, and even if you have companions nearby, you're probably not doing a lot of talking. Certainly when I was hiking uphill, I never had enough breath to do any talking. Sean Ferris, while through hiking the Pacific Crest Trail in 1989, said this: "You hike alone, and you get to know yourself pretty well, and you find some things about yourself you don't like, but you also find some things you didn't know you had." I had some of that experience. A mind removed from the daily bustle of work and to-do lists is free to go where it might. Many hikers report that their minds dredged up memories they had long forgotten. My mind seemed bent on reviewing as many embarrassing events from my past as it could. And here again, I was thankful for my Zen practice. And this is what we do in Zazen, the meditative practice for which the Zen tradition is named. Thoughts occur in your mind. You can't stop that. But you can decide what you want to spend energy on. As thoughts arise, if you're aware of them and what they are, you can choose not to attach to them. Attach here meaning some version of celebrating, suppressing, arguing with, debating, etc. The practice is to simply see the thoughts as they arise and let them go. And over time, allow the mind to settle like cloudy water eventually settles into clarity. So working with that on the trail, somewhere south of Brandon Gap, I had the realization and real understanding that no matter how hard I might try, my past self won't ever be a more together person. Seems obvious, but it took me a while. A slow study. In reaching that understanding, I began to grasp that if my past had been different, then I'd be different. And I'd be a person I don't know. It's a blind alley. It's useless speculation. And now when versions of those thoughts come up, and of course they still do, I find it's much easier now to just let them go. I find real reward in getting some places by my own means. The world on foot is fundamentally different from the fast-paced world most of us know. Exploring the world at a human's pace is a way of connecting with an earlier time and perhaps a more elemental, essential self. When the notion of just another 10 miles doesn't mean 10 more minutes in climate-controlled comfort, but rather 3 to 5 hours of hard work, something changes. The world is different. What items are essential for a good life? I could have given you a laundry list before starting my hike. Now I'd say perhaps my summer list would include drinking water, a dry sleeping bag, and food. A hot dinner is a nice luxury. Anything else? Short term? Not really. As I said at the start, I'm naturally an introvert. But on the trail, I found the infrequency of meeting others made me actually welcome the company of strangers. That was new for me. The day hikers and weekend hikers were the most disappointing in this regard. They often weren't as starved for social interaction and didn't want to stop to chat. But that said, the overnight hikers were the best folks to camp with. They always brought way too much food and didn't want to carry it back out. My second best night on the trail at Cooley Glen Shelter was thanks to two young grad students from Burlington who brought the makings for s'mores and a bottle of Jim Beam. The best night was two nights later at David Logan Shelter, and I got to tell my two trail buddies, Brian and Snags, that they both missed the s'mores and bean party. In the course of my hike, I suffered two infected fingers, severe tendonitis in both feet and ankles, and I bruised my right thigh badly enough that walking on it made me sob at times. But even at its worst, I had a blast. I saw snowshoe hare for the first time in my life. I had grouse erupt from under my feet more times than I could count. Every time they scared the bejesus out of me, and then I laughed and laughed as the shock wore off. On top of Mount Mansfield, I was socked in with fog and rain and winds gusting at 50 miles an hour. But late that afternoon, the fog dropped and the cloud deck rose and the sun shone brightly on me for 30 seconds. It was my only view of the sun that whole day. It was due in the west, dead even with my elevation, shining a narrow slot of with a sliver of blue behind, bleeding red into the fog below and the clouds above. It was my own personal parting of the Red Sea. It was amazing. Several times I watched 50-foot birch trees lift most of their root mass out of the thin mountain soil, counterbalancing their trunks as they pivoted like teeter-totters in the wind. And I stayed the heck away from them. Jeez. I learned what a pleasure it was to drift off to sleep in the company of a dozen or more owls. And on the three nights I spent alone on the trail, I learned something more of the nature and value of solitude. So I think I've been pretty clear that hiking works for me. But in a larger sense, it seems that much of my life's work is exploration at a human pace and scale, on foot, in a kayak, farming on all fours. All that suggests reaching for a connection with life that I can't achieve by driving past, flying over, or reading about. I'm made the way I am, but you are you. You have your own thing, or things. I think my takeaway here today is intimacy. Finding intimacy with the life you are drawn to, the commitment to undertake what you're called to do, and the courage to examine why it's important. The fourth principle of Unitarian Universalism is a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. So this is my answer to why I hiked the long trail, because it is one way our fourth principle is made manifest in my life. I look forward to learning more about how that principle is made manifest in yours. Thank you.